If you haven't received training through a webinar yet, it's only a matter of time. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Arrow News. Welcome into the Arrow News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, also of Bob Miller Flight Training in the Western New York area, and now Bob Miller Flight Training Online. And the online part is what we're going to talk about a little bit today. Bob, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners.
Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk first about why Bob Miller Flight Training has evolved into Bob Miller Flight Training Online. It's kind of a new venture, and it actually kind of worked out at a good time considering what the weather has done to your industry in Western New York this winter.
Well, it was truly providential putting this up. I did not expect to have such an overwhelming positive support to the webinar program. I got intrigued by webinar technology, having been a participant in a number of webinars, but I was never a presenter or an organizer of one. So we ran a pilot program started in November, this past November, for a primary pilot course, and we had a number of technical challenges, but our audience stayed with us right through the 8-week series, and so we launched in January another one on 8-week instrument pilot, a ground school refresher type course, and the response has just been overwhelmingly positive. We've surveyed our audience after each. We're into the sixth session, and the audience response has been very, very strong. We had about 123 people registered for this one, and it turned out to be a very, very good experience, both from the listeners' perspective and from our perspective, in terms of just supplementing desperately needed income in the flight school during this bad December and January weather we've been having.
You've been doing this for a long time, Bob, flying and instructing. What were the challenges in adapting from an instructor's point of view, in-person classroom training, to presenting online?
Oh, I want to tell you, Paul, there is a trick to this. You're a consummate professional yourself in using technology to communicate to an unseen face, and I'm not. And when I had to face the prospect of teaching a class to 120 people that I could not see, and instead looking at a still computer screen, and you do not have the benefit of the body language of the listener. Is your audience with you or are they not? So we had to employ a little bit of additional technology so that we could offer our listeners or our participants an immediate way of asking questions, which we finally mastered that little piece of the process. And so now it's working a whole lot more effectively. But it took about 6 or 7 2-hour sessions for me to become comfortable presenting in the webinar format.
Okay, what challenges does it present for a participant? Because I know anyone who listens to this podcast is probably dealing with the internet and new media enough to see opportunities come down all the time for this kind of distance learning, whether it's in an ad hoc course or a long-running university course that you sign up for a semester. But what's the difference from a participant's point of view, and what do you need to keep in mind there?
Oh, okay. Very good question, Paul. Having listened and participated in a number of webinars, if the presenter is not animated, if the presentation, the videos are not changing quickly, if we're not keeping on task and moving the process right along, it's very easy to kind of zone out as a participant. We have to keep in mind as a presenter that these individuals are just a click away from turning us off altogether. And that became the challenge. You know, when I do it, I try to speak to the lowest common denominator in terms of listener understanding of the subject without, you know, just making it so simple that the more advanced listeners, we don't lose them. So it really is a trick. And one of the things that I did find very useful is to survey the audience after each presentation, just using some survey technology. We can get out a 10 or 15 or 20 item survey and ask for, you know, their frank comments. What did you think? Were we too fast? Were we too slow? Were the slides sufficient? Did they advance fast enough? And their feedback was taken very, very seriously, and we were able to modify our approach accordingly.
Well, I've been looking at this technology for a number of reasons lately, and I have sat in on a bunch of different kinds of webinars, And it almost looks to me as if the real challenge for a lot of people in presenting one of these is not so much mastering the technology as it is just basic PowerPoint skills, knowing what is overload on a slide, or knowing how fast to move them, or knowing that you put a bullet point on the slide, not the entire paragraph. And I've seen a lot of them that just don't seem to get a handle on the graphics side of that. Did you, coming from a business background, have a leg up there?
No, I had no leg up on there. In fact, we worked with GoToWebinar, the company that hosts the actual webinar for us, and talk with them about things that we needed to do to make this more effective. And the one suggestion they gave me that we really took to heart was practice, practice, practice. You can set up and host a webinar just to a very select group of one or two or three people, or just to yourself. Practice it, record it, play it back, and see how it is working. But I do not want to underplay the technical challenges. As I said, in our first 8-week series, it took us almost halfway, or perhaps through week 5 or 6, just to get the outgoing technology working right. And then surveying our audience, we found that initially there was some difficulty having them understand how they could log in, how they could listen. And then before long, we knew what to tell them in terms of instruction. We knew how to brief them. And now it really is very, very simple. But there is a fairly steep learning curve. And I think that's one reason why we have not seen webinar type approaches take off as to their full potential. We have not even scratched the surface. The ability to attend a very worthwhile instructional session right from your living room or office, much the way our listeners are doing right now in this podcast, but to add the video component with the PowerPoint presentation, it just amplifies the learnability so much more when you can do it in both ways, and then make it fully interactive so that our listeners can chime in at any time with a question. And then lastly, Paul, within 24 hours after the live version, they can go online and then play back a full recording of the any of the previous webinars that we did. So if there was a point that they didn't understand or they didn't hear clearly, they can go back and play it over and over and over again.
AOPA's Air Safety Foundation, or the AOPA Foundation as it's now called, for years has had these traveling roadshows that were phenomenally, I really, really enjoyed them, where you'd go free to the ballroom at the Marriott and sit in for a 2-hour session that I felt was very valuable to have been there, and very few people among the pilot population did that. We also know that there are applications for this maybe in formal ground school training or is half of the ground half of a flight review. Does this in any way threaten, or should it threaten? Is it time it threatened the traditional sit down in a brick and mortar room environment?
Oh, I think it does. I don't know if it threatens it, but I think it's a much more effective way to communicate from a resource perspective. You know, going out to 40 or 50 people in a live seminar in a community, when you could go out to 100, 200, there's really no limit to what you can do on a webinar. And it's so much easier to come home, as I said, kick off your shoes, sit in your comfortable chair, and listen interactively. And also, I think it uses time more effectively. I know I have 2 hours to fill with a 5-minute break on the webinar. And if I don't keep it moving, keep those slides advancing quickly, keep those slides very, very colorful, keep them as animated as I possibly can, I'm going to lose the audience. So it does force a lot more work on the webinar presenter. You know, we would do this routinely in our flight school, and I would have 20 or 30 people come out, and I'd have to go through the same effort with 20 or 30 people. Now, with the webinar, we're going out to, as I said, over 100 people at a time. And I suspect as this word gets out even further that our webinars are going to increase. It's, you know, it's this old adage, if it's worthwhile to you, then you'll tell your friend, and your friend will tell a friend. And before you know it, you've got this exponential explosion. It goes, as we say in the social media environment, it goes viral. So I expect fully that we will have 400 to 500 people on a webinar at any one point in time. It's just the next step in the evolution of technology that just simply makes sense.
What is the practical limit of how many people you could put on a session and still be able to handle the interactivity that results?
All right. I do not want to underplay the importance of technical support. We have Matt Spear and Brian Clement, who both are technology experts. They're fielding questions now for me as I do the live presentation. And they see a hand go up on their control screen. They immediately dialogue with the questioner, get an understanding of what the question is, and then they're gathering questions throughout the presentation. What we do is we run an hour, or we run about 50 minutes, and then save 10 minutes for questions. Well, Matt and Brian screen the questions, they group the common questions, and then they give them to me at the 50-minute mark, and then they do the same thing at the end of the second hour. So, yeah, there's going to be some loss of individual opportunity when you're competing for the presenter's time and asking your particular question. But we also leave the invitation open so that they can ask via email following the session, saying, hey, you know, what was this all about, or what did you mean by that? So that's a minor point when on the other hand, you can reach so many more people with the same expenditure of time and effort. This is what makes the webinar that much more effective, I believe.
All right. Now, when we come back from the break, I want to talk about the next series you have coming up that starts March 15th. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Piperjet.
Pipermatch.
Global expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved. At facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to the special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And talking about webinars in general, and Bob, I want to shift gears and talk about the next series you have starting on Tuesday night, May 15th, which will run for four consecutive Tuesday nights. Tell us who this is for, because it's got an intriguing sounding title.
The one coming up on the 15th of March is Accident Analysis, Lessons Learned for the General Aviation Pilot. We know from my work with Over the Airwaves that have been going out now for better than 8 years, that surveying the audience of some 15,000 readers, the greatest fascination still seems to be with lessons learned from NTSB reports that I summarize periodically through on each issue. We want to know, as pilots, could this happen to us? We believe it could not, but there's a little still voice inside our ear that says, yes, this could happen to us. So that what I wanted to do is bring forth in 4 weeks probably 15, 16 different classic accident scenarios that we can talk about that had an accident chain that could have easily been broken very early. No, you can read the NTSB accident reports, and you have to read through a lot of technical information, a lot of metallurgy, and there's only so much meat in each NTSB report. And what I've tried to do is bring out the meat, and we'll be showing it in such a way, relating in such a way, that I think all of our listeners will have a clear understanding that this could have been any one of us, and the reasons why. And then lastly, if we understand what went wrong in those accidents, will that make us a more defensive pilot? Will that cause us to do a better pre-flight? Will it cause us to improve our aeronautical decision-making based upon the actual accidents of others? I believe it will. And time will tell. We'll see what the reader our listener response to this seminar will be.
Well, let me ask you this question, too. If you're going to study accidents that don't particularly apply to my type of aircraft, for example, if you talk about things that happen to somebody in a Lancair and I fly, a J3 or a gyroplane or a weight shift trike or a business jet, How much commonality is there in terms of what goes wrong between all the different aircraft types, and how valuable will this be to someone who doesn't fly the particular type of aircraft being studied?
All right, we know, good question, Paul. We know that 80% of all fatal accidents are caused by pilot error, pilot factors. 10% are caused by mechanical factors in the aircraft, and the other 10% we're really not quite sure of. So something is going on with pilots, we pilots, as we operate our airplanes. We also suspect that of the 80% that are pilot error, about 80% of those involved a bad decision on the part of the pilot. The decision might be, I have a rough running engine, I'm going to try and stretch it to an airport as opposed to on a safe off-field site. That's a bad decision. A decision to launch into marginal VFR conditions at night and then have that flight go into solid IMC and the pilot lose control. That's a bad aeronautical decision. That's not a skilled decision. So whether you're flying a Lance Air or a Cessna Corvallis or a rotorcraft or a gyro airplane, if we can cause all of us, and, you know, as I point my finger out, there's four fingers pointing right back at me, and this has always been helpful to me. I always anticipate, could this have been me? What do I do when I fly that could result in a bad outcome if I make such and such a decision? And that's all I'm trying to do, is to get all of us to think. Just think before we fly, think ahead, anticipate each move that we're doing, and then lastly, do that all-important what-if analysis, and do I have a back door for every possible corner I might work myself into? If I haven't considered those, then I'm vulnerable to a bad outcome.
All right, Bob, if someone wants to take advantage of the series, where can they find more information?
Probably the easiest way to get to it will be through BobMillerFlightTraining.com.
All right, Bob, well, as always, we appreciate your breaking some new ground and making us think, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
If you'd like to receive Bob Miller's free online newsletter, register at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plagg. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.